Welcome to the official companion podcast series to the Showmax original, Catch Me a Killer. If you're coming across this companion podcast for the first time, this is the third installment and covers Catch Me a Killer, episode 4. If you haven't listened to the other companion pods, or heaven forbid, if you haven't started watching Showmax's original Catch Me a Killer yet, you need to do that first and come back. If you're all caught up and ready to go, let's do it. In episode 4 of Catch Me a Killer, renowned profiler Mickey Pistorius is tracking the ABC killer. Those who know their true crime, or who've listened to my original episode on this killer, will know that this killer's name was Moses Sithole. Thankfully, this week we don't have any legal considerations about identity. Spoiler alert, Sithole was found guilty and convicted and is still in prison today, so we can delve a little bit deeper into this one. South Africa is not as big on serial killer monikers as the US is, and for that I'm eternally grateful. For those of you who listen to my podcast, you'll know I moved away from using serial killer monikers in titles of episodes a long time ago. My opinion on that is that until we can all recite the names of the victims of each and every serial killer, where we can say all the fancy monikers and real names of serial killers, then serial killers should not have fancy labels that make them sound flashy. Again, thankfully in South Africa, on the occasion that we do give serial killers monikers, they aren't terribly sensational and usually just revolve around the areas in which the killer has hunted or disposed of their victims. In Moses Sithole's case, he was referred to as the ABC killer because he killed in Attridgeville, Boksburg, and Cleveland. But technically, he should have been called the CBA killer because he started killing in Cleveland, moved on to Boksburg, and then killed in Attridgeville. When he had taken victims in Cleveland, of course, his series coincided with that of the Cleveland serial killer believed to be David Selepe, who I spoke about in the last companion episode. I did a pretty long episode on Moses Sithole right in the beginning of my podcast journey, and I'll link that in the show notes too. Today I'm going to give you a short summary of the details of this case, and then we'll delve into an interesting aspect of Sithole's crime progression, which we often see in other serial killers. Born in Johannesburg on November the 17th, 1964, Moses was the fourth child in a family of six. Tragedy struck when he was only 10 years old, with the sudden death of his father. Left without a source of income, Moses's mother, Sophie, felt overwhelmed and abandoned her six children at a police station, threatening them with violence if they revealed her as their mother. The children were then placed in an orphanage where Moses suffered physical, emotional, and sexual abuse for 3 years. At around 14 years old, he ran away in search of his mother, but was rejected once again when he found her. Moses eventually moved in with his older brother in Vosloorus, but the stability didn't last as his brother lost his job and had to relocate. Moses then sold the house illegally and embarked on a journey across the country, taking odd jobs to survive. At the age of 23, Moses's behavior took a darker turn. In September 1987, he committed his first recorded rape, targeting a woman named Patricia Kumalo. Over the following years, Moses continued to assault and rape women, with the violence in each attack escalating. One of Moses's victims, Buyiswa Swagamisa, displayed remarkable courage by reporting her rape to the police. However, Moses managed to avoid conviction due to using an alias during the crime. Nevertheless, he encountered Buyiswa again on the street, leading to his arrest, but not before subjecting her to further verbal abuse. Moses was convicted for the rape on Buyiswa, and while in prison, he alleged that he faced brutal attacks from fellow inmates, which he claimed only heightened his hatred toward women. During his initial incarceration, Moses met Martha, who would become his common-law wife. Upon his release in 1993, he moved in with Martha and her family, presenting himself as a job-seeking mechanic. In early 1994, Martha announced that she was pregnant, and it was around this time that Moses began his deadly spree. His first confirmed murder victim was 19-year-old Maria Monama, who was found raped and strangled in Cleveland. In the late 1990s, a series of gruesome murders had shocked South Africa, specifically in the areas of Cleveland and Attridgeville. The initial investigation focused on a man named David Selepe, who was believed to be the Cleveland serial killer. However, many inconsistencies arose, leading the task team to realize that there were actually two killers active at the same time. The first victim, which both Sithole and Selepe were initially thought to be responsible for, was Amanda Tete, who disappeared in August 1994. She was later found raped and strangled, with her own clothing having been used to silence her. Unfortunately, due to poor administration and a lost docket, her identity was unknown for a long time. Eventually, her father identified her photo in a newspaper, leading to the realization that she'd already been found, but her body had lay unidentified in the morgue. Joyce Mashabela, another victim, vanished shortly after Amanda. A man calling himself Moses Sima contacted her employer and provided identification documents allegedly belonging to Joyce. Her body was discovered later, bearing signs of assault and strangulation. Although it was unclear whether Joyce's family identified Moses Sithole as the man who'd handed over the documents, the coincidence of the name raised suspicions. A similar pattern emerged with Amanda Mokale, who was lured with the promises of a job before her disappearance. She, too, was found raped and strangled with her own bra. The identification process for her, as well as other victims, was hindered, causing confusion in assigning culpability. Rose Mokgotsi, the last victim of 1994, went missing after arranging a meeting for a job opportunity. She was discovered raped and strangled near a hotel in Boksburg. Subsequently, a task force called the Cleveland Serial Killer Squad was created to investigate the series of murders. David Selepe, a local businessman facing financial trouble, was identified as a person of interest. He was arrested and confessed to committing the murders. However, doubts about his guilt arose, and his alleged accomplice, Mandla, was interviewed without substantial evidence ever linking him to the crimes. During a police visit to Amanda Tete's murder site led by Selepe, an officer was attacked by the man who was armed with a stick. Selepe was shot and killed, raising public concern and prompting further questioning of the case. In January 1995, an unidentified decomposed female body was found near Attridgeville, adding to the growing list of victims. Beauty Soko, Sarah Mokono, and Nikiwe Diko also fell prey to the killer, with their bodies discovered over the following months in various locations. The killer's methods evolved, as evidenced by the use of a garrote and disturbing mutilation. With the increasing frequency of murders, a new task team was formed to investigate the killings in the Pretoria and Atteridgeville area. However, the police still maintain Selepe's guilt for the Cleveland cases. The investigators struggled to keep up with the rapid pace of the murders, with one scene interrupting the autopsy of another victim. With Selepe now dead, the task team realized that the murders still continuing had to be as a result of another killer. The killer, of course, was Moses Sithole, and he was escalating incredibly quickly. A major breakthrough came when the bodies of 10 women were discovered at Van Dyke Mine near Boksburg. Due to the intense media coverage, Moses Sithole had moved back to Germiston, Cleveland, and Benoni. With the similarities between the Van Dyke Mine victims and those in Pretoria, the investigation teams combined their efforts. Police identified some more victims, including Nelisiwe Zulu, Amelia Rapodile, Monica Vilikazi, and Makobo Mahotsi, through identification documents found at the crime scenes. As investigators delved deeper, they discovered that Moses Sithole had used his real name in telephone conversations with victims' family members. The victims' places of work and interviews led back to a fake charity organization he claimed to represent, further strengthening the case against him. Moses Sithole had become audacious, using his sister's telephone number to collect information from potential victims. The hunt for Moses Sithole intensified as his name and an identikit were published in the media. Authorities received crucial information from his sister, confirming his involvement in the crimes. As the hunt for the killer intensified, journalist Tamsin De Beer received a phone call from a man claiming to be Sithole. Voice experts confirmed his identity, and Tamsin cooperated with the police to set up a trap. During subsequent calls, the caller shared details of his crimes and revealed the locations of two victims. The police found the bodies matching the descriptions. Meanwhile, another journalist named Charles Mohane attempted to strike a deal with Moses, but failed to meet up with him. Moses later contacted his sister, requesting a gun. She alerted the police, who arranged a sting operation. Moses attacked an undercover officer with an axe, but he was wounded and arrested. In custody, Moses initially remained silent, but eventually opened up, describing his crimes in explicit and disturbing detail. Initially admitting to 10 murders, Moses faced charges of 38 counts of murder, 40 counts of rape, and 6 counts of robbery. As the trial began a year after his arrest, it became evident that some victims previously attributed to David Selepe were actually victims of Moses Sithole. The increased accuracy of DNA technology played a crucial role in linking Moses to these victims. While the police acknowledged their errors, they did not specify which crimes were falsely attributed to Selepe. Huge crowds gathered outside the sealed-off courtroom, protesting Moses Sithole's acts of violence against women. During the trial, the state called upon 350 witnesses to testify, including Moses's earlier rape victims. They aimed to establish his consistent modus operandi throughout his criminal history. Sibongile, Moses's former partner, testified about their abusive relationship. When challenged by Moses's attorney, she offered to expose the scars he'd left on her body. dispelling his claim that his hatred for women was a consequence of an unjust conviction. Mickey Pistorius noted a clear progression in Moses's crimes, from rape to manual strangulation, the use of a garrote, and ultimately tying victims to trees for self-strangulation. Moses' defense argued that he was coerced into confessing and that the police showed him the crime scenes. Some of the murder victims initially attributed to David Selepe presented challenges in proving Moses' involvement. In the case of Amanda Tete, CCTV stills showing a man using her bank card were first identified as Selepe. However, during Moses' trial, two witnesses, including his sister, testified that it was actually Moses in the pictures. Moses' DNA was found inside Amanda, but he had had a relationship with her at one point, and this raised the possibility of consensual encounters. However, the likelihood of the coincidence was slim, considering that a girlfriend of one serial killer would have had to have been killed by another. Joyce Mashabela, a victim who was initially attributed to Selepe, also had Moses' DNA in her body. Interestingly, another body was found near Joyce's location, but that murder was not attributed to Moses. Similar incidents occurred in Pretoria, where one woman was found murdered in the same area where Moses' victim, Amanda Mokale, was located. However, this particular murder was not linked to him. On the 5th of December 1997, Moses Sithole was found guilty of all the charges against him. He was sentenced to 2,410 years in jail. The judge stated that he wished that the death sentence had not been abolished the year before, because if he could, he would take great pleasure in sentencing Moses Sithole to the gallows. Moses's progression from rapist to killer is not uncommon. This is, in fact, one of the reasons that it's so vital for parole boards to understand the nature of sexual offenders and to very carefully consider their release. We've seen this happen in many, many cases I've covered on the podcast. A sex offender will be caught for a sex offense and sent to jail. They get some ridiculously short sentence, and they're released on parole because they're believed to be rehabilitated. But they aren't. And within a pretty short space of time, they are reoffending again. Except this time, they've decided they aren't going back to prison, and they will not leave any of their victims alive to tell the tale. Moses Sithole claimed he'd killed because he hated women, and I'm sure that absolutely was an element of what drove him. But the truth was that the murder was just an increased element of control. And the control is what his rape crimes were about too. Progression between crimes is common for all types of criminals, really. Robbers, fraudsters, home invasion gangs. There's always a bigger score, a more profitable crime. But for a small group of criminals, that progression is deadly. When the high gained from sexual assault or exposing themselves or peeping Tom activity is not enough, they need to do something else. Something in which the power they have is greater. And that never, ever ends well for the victims. Of course, there are sex offenders who do not progress to murder. We've sadly seen many serial rapists being arrested in the last few years as our DNA databases for incarcerated offenders finally get off the ground. Even there, though, if you look at the individual cases closely enough, you'll see a progression of violence or intimidation of the victims. And although we now have significantly longer sentences for sex offenders than we did in the 80s or 90s, if one of these serial rapists were to be granted parole, there's a very good chance they would reoffend, and those victims would not be left alive. Have sex offenders been rehabilitated? Depending on the nature of the sex offence, yes, it is possible. But these offenders are one of the most difficult types of offenders to rehabilitate, and also some of the riskiest to parole. Moses Sithole's earliest rape victim did get some form of justice for the original crime on her. He was jailed, but imagine her horror when she discovered that the man who'd been released had gone on to do what he did. She testified in his murder trial because the judge needed to understand that this was lifelong behavior for Moses. This wasn't something he just started doing because, as he claimed, he was angry at women. He was a habitual predator and would continue to be a threat to women if he was ever released back into society. It is perhaps a beautiful irony that the man who so deeply hated women and sought to control their bodies and their lives was caught, in large part, thanks to the dedicated work of a female profiler. Showmax's original Catch Me a Killer is getting rave reviews from viewers. It really is an incredibly well-made production, and in future episodes we'll get to see more of the terrifying killers Mickey Pistorius helped put behind bars. I know you're looking forward to these fascinating episodes of the show just as much as I am. And I'll be back with you again next week to do a deep dive into the cases covered on Showmax's Catch Me a Killer.